This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on current thoughts in the transition between the acute care and skilled nursing settings. The 2009 landmark report in the New England Journal of Medicine by Jenks and others that identified high hospital readmission rates and the possible reasons behind them empowered a national effort to minimize the risk of patients returning to the acute care setting, with further studies suggested to address failures in discharge planning, insufficient outpatient and community care, and severe progressive illness. The accompanying editorial to the study commented that a sensible policy would be to create shared incentives for more efficient care and better coordination of care between the inpatient and outpatient settings, while also looking at the financial impact, which might include administering penalties. Just 2 years later, Gonzalo and others published a report in the same journal, which started off with, "The hospitalization of nursing home residents has the potential for fragmentation of care, changes in the management of chronic diseases, duplication of diagnostic workups, and medical errors." But also in 2011, with the understanding that a substantial number of hospitalizations from the nursing home setting could be avoidable, Dr. Joseph Auslander and others presented data in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society from the use of Interventions to Reduce Acute Care Transfers, or INTERACT, a quality initiative that included tools for identification, assessment, and communication around changes of status that led to a decreased need for acute level care. And through his ongoing work in the field, Dr. Auslander's research continued to advocate for and promote strategies that reduced hospital admissions. The questions are, have we made any headway in reducing hospital admissions from the skilled setting over the past 10 years? Are we adopting strategies like INTERACT to help appropriately in the effort? Does nursing facility care lack in the ability to provide quality care in place, without relying on the hospital? And a most recent article, based on a case study, again from the New England Journal of Medicine, suggests that significant barriers remain in improving or even addressing transitions. Where are we in this effort? Well, to help us navigate from where we've been to where we could be, we are privileged to have Dr. Joseph Auslander with us now. Dr. Auslander is an internationally recognized geriatrician who is also co-author of Essentials of Clinical Geriatrics, editor of Principles of Geriatric Medicine and Gerontology, executive editor of the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, a member of the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, JAMDA, board, a member of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Foundation board, and professor and chair of the Department of Integrated Medical Science at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine of Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Auslander, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Auslander, I typically like to start our discussions with somewhat of a historical perspective. In your 2016 Journal of the American Medical Director Association study entitled Hospital Transfers of Skilled Nursing Facility, or SNF, Patients Within 48 Hours and 30 Days After SNF Admission, you looked at facility root cause analyses to learn about the reasons and characteristics behind the transfers. The list of conditions was quite long, with some clear differences between the two readmission time points. You know, how has this information changed over time, or has it? What is different 10 years ago compared to now? How have our considerations about transitioning patients between these two settings changed, and what have we learned? A bunch of questions to start your time.
Well, it's a really good question, and to try and answer directly, I think we've learned a lot. And I'm not sure that the issues that we face in transitioning people from hospitals to skilled nursing facilities and back and forth that we can intervene on have changed that much since I started working on this issue intensively about 12 years ago. The study that you cite, I think one of the main messages of that study is that root cause analyses, structured root cause analyses, are important to do at a facility level. They're also very good to do jointly with hospitals, and look at individual cases, but summarize the data so that you can see trends over time. Even if the transfers at an individual facility are infrequent, you can see trends in what are the factors associated with transfers back and forth. So we've actually published a number of studies of root cause analyses that we've done in association with implementing the Interact program. And to your question about the history, the first study was really was the expert panel process that we went through when I was working for the Quality Improvement Organization in Georgia in a CMS-supported contract that actually resulted in the first Interact toolkit. We gathered hospital and skilled nursing facility records on about 200 people and had them had structured root cause analyses done by expert clinicians. And what they found formed the basis for the Interact program was that changes in condition needed to be recognized earlier, that they needed to be communicated and documented more effectively. There needed to be decision support on how to manage those changes in condition when safe and feasible in the facility. And a big issue that we can talk more about is the role of advanced care planning. A lot of the transfers in that first study were rated as potentially avoidable because the expert clinicians felt that the patient was going back and forth to the hospital and that going back to the hospital was potentially uncomfortable and futile care. And that is why advanced care planning is a component of the Interact program. Mm. These reasons are reinforced by a study that was published previously to the one you cited, which was kind of an overview of the findings of root cause analyses from facilities implementing Interact. And this is based on about 4,800 transfers that were reviewed retrospectively by the facilities participating in our project. We also published data on close to 2,000 other transfers. And the similarities were remarkable. After going through a structured root cause analysis, the question was asked, in retrospect, do you think that this transfer could have been avoided or prevented? And each time we've looked at this, staff in the facility that have done the root cause analysis have answered that question, yes, this transfer could have been prevented. Or possibly have been prevented or avoided 20 to 25% of the time.
Wow.
And the reasons are the ones that I listed earlier. The specific study you're talking about is interesting. The questions you asked are interesting. This was the same 4,800 transfers we just looked at in a little different way. And you mentioned that a lot of things became statistically significant. But the fact is that there were a large number, so things become statistically significant. I'll just point out two or three things that I think are clinically relevant here from that study. One is that we found that one of the symptoms that was associated with transfer to the hospital back rapidly was shortness of breath. So even if you go back to the Jenks study, the most common cause of hospital readmissions in that population was the principal diagnosis was heart failure. But in a nursing facility, shortness of breath could, as we all know, could be, you know, a dozen different things. It may not just be heart failure, maybe many other things. But the fact is that that really means that nursing facility staff and the medical providers need to be prepared to evaluate and manage shortness of breath whenever it's safe and feasible in the facility. On the opposite end of that, we found that the new onset of urinary incontinence, or the fact that a urinalysis and urine culture were done more frequently in transfers that were longer in duration, I think that speaks to the fact that we still have a problem in our facilities with the appropriate diagnosis and treatment of true urinary tract infection versus asymptomatic bacteriuria.
Right.
And the third thing I'll say is the other condition that was associated with transfers that were longer after admission were falls. And this is a topic we could spend the whole podcast talking about, but I'll just say that there was a very nice study published by Robert Burke and his colleagues in JAMDA a couple years ago, and I wrote an editorial about transfers to the emergency department and preventable transfers to the emergency department. And a lot of the preventable transfers to the emergency department are a result of falls without injury. And there was another really nice randomized controlled trial published recently in the last year, where it was published by emergency medicine physicians, where they actually did protocols in assisted living facilities, where they had clinical evaluations and didn't transfer everyone to the emergency room initially after a fall. And that dramatically reduced the transfers to the emergency department. So I'm saying that because these kind of root cause analyses can really give, you know, people clinical insights into where to focus educational and quality improvement efforts.
You know, I'm wrapping my head around the 25% avoidable, which, as I'm extrapolating out, we're talking about millions of dollars easily for cost savings.
Well, I think it depends on how you calculate the costs, and you can, but it's nationwide. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars,
yeah,
not over $1 billion. And the other thing is, it's not just the money. I mean, people who care, who provide care to our population know that transfers are hard work for staff. They can be physically and emotionally traumatic for residents, cause a lot of disruption with the family. And once the person goes to the hospital, there's a potential for harm. So we're spending a lot of money, but we're also causing a lot of issues that if one could prevent a few of those transfers, you would do a lot of good.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit more about Interact. A number of years ago, in recognition of the poor communication that existed between my own institution and its most commonly discharged to skilled nursing facility, I actually brought leadership from both sides to the table to discuss improving transitions. And I also brought with me a red, white, and blue document with the word Interact on it. The emergency room staff had never heard of the form, and the skilled nursing setting, seeing that efforts to complete the form went unnoticed, stopped using it. So tell us a little bit about Interact, maybe some more of the history behind it. But given the nuances of Interact, how do you find its different products are being used today? You know, how do we recognize its benefit within the continuum of care, is it surviving the tests of time?
Well, good question. I would say it is surviving the test of time. I think Interact has become almost a metaphor for strategies and tools to try and prevent avoidable hospital transfers. You know, I applaud you for meeting with your hospital partners because we've found that that's very effective because you get different perspectives. Not all, some hospitalizations are potentially avoidable, not because of anything that was done or not done in the skilled nursing facility, but might have been done or not done in the hospital. And getting the perspective of the and jointly meeting in a collegial way can be very helpful. The question you ask about utilization of Interact is really interesting, and it really doesn't only relate to the Interact program. It relates to how do you effectively disseminate interventions and get organizations to adopt them and sustain their use. And that's, I think that's, you know, and this is kind of embedded in implementation science. I mean, many times we know what to do, either through evidence or through expert opinion, but we can't get it done. And that's not only true with the Interact program. And, you know, we have been frustrated by the incomplete adoption of Interact tools. We've tried to incorporate them into an overall quality improvement framework and suggested that the program be incorporated into organizations' quality improvement and QAPI programs. We've had a hard time getting the program reviewed and understood by attending physicians, despite multiple sessions at AMDA national and state meetings. And the way I view this is like a complex geriatric patient, the causes of incomplete adoption of Interact and other programs are multifactorial. The incentives in terms of quality of care, potential for regulatory sanctions, and financial consequences have to be very strong to adopt any program. Now, those are high main drivers of change and adoption and sustaining programs. In the specific case of the Interact transfer form, some states and organizations have developed their own form. And that's why, in addition, we have a recommended list of data to include on any form that's used. We actually developed that list of with input from emergency department physicians and nurses, asking them, what is the essential information that you need to make a decision about a patient transferred from a skilled nursing facility? And I know in Florida has actually done a good job on their state form, incorporating much of the data onto the state interfacility transfer form. And to that question also, we recently published data in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society last fall that demonstrate that facilities that increase use of the core tools of the Interact program have lower rates of all-cause and potentially avoidable hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. That was just published. We are working on improving our education with our partner Pathway Health. Pathway does the education and training on Interact. And we are in the process of working collaboratively with the American Geriatric Society to develop a course on Interact and its implementation for clinicians. So we think that'll be helpful. The other thing I'll say is that we've been working for, and I just right as I before I got before we've been talking, I was on a call with our we've been working very closely with Point Click Care, which I think much of the audience will know is in 50 to 60% of post-acute care facilities in the United States. And we are working very hard with them to incorporate the Interact paper and pencil tools into eInteract. And we're at the stage with them now, actually, that we're going to be working on their provider engagement module so that, alerts and relevant information can be pushed to clinicians in a usable way so they can make good decisions when they're not on site in the facility. So there's a lot more we can do to get elements of the Interact program used.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Among all charitable organizations, our foundation uniquely advances the interests of PALTC professionals by working to develop and expand our workforce and by focusing on innovation and quality improvement. Your contributions to the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine make a big difference. Please make a contribution today through our website or by calling the AMDA office.
We're talking with Dr. Joseph Auslander about acute care and skilled nursing transitions. Dr. Auslander, the January 31st, 2018 issue of the New England Journal featured a perspective piece called Rehabbed to Death. Difficult title aside, at a superficial glance, it appeared that the nursing facility was being downplayed as a deficit to care in our continuum, where elders go in and go out and then go to die and do so poorly. But when you take a deeper dive into the article, it really shows that there are ongoing questions as to Medicare interventions and policies that could improve the system, better payment strategies, improving communication, better prognostics. I think advanced care planning, in essence, was mentioned. But it seems like the same conversation, essentially, that came out of the 2009 Jenks paper. What is your take on this? Are we headed in the right direction when it comes to the skilled nursing facility, acute care setting, transitions of care?
So I'm glad you mentioned this article. I saw this just this past week, and I actually think it's a wonderful article. And that's not because I work with and highly respect the senior author, Alex Smith. He's one of our deputy editors on the Journal of American Geriatric Society and just a brilliant person. I didn't read that paper as much about transitions in care or anything negative about skilled nursing facilities. I read it as describing a dilemma that most of us face every day in the care of complex, acutely ill older patients, especially patients that are towards the end of life and going back and forth between skilled nursing facilities and hospitals, hence the title, Rehab to Death. The dilemma has to do with Medicare reimbursement. I saw that paper and read it the day after I was on teaching rounds at one of our affiliated hospitals here at Florida Atlantic University. And I spent 30 minutes in a patient's room, a 101-year-old woman with five of her family members, myself, my resident nurse practitioner, and a palliative care nurse, trying to explain to the family member that their 101-year-old matriarch, who had been going in and out of the hospital from a skilled nursing facility and just had another stroke, I tried to explain to them what the options were. And one option was to go back to the skilled nursing facility and make further attempts at rehabilitation. The other option was to go to consider hospice and palliative care. However, the family wasn't prepared to take her home. They couldn't take her home. And when you go on hospice, Medicare doesn't pay the room and board in the skilled nursing facility.
For routine.
Doesn't pay for it. for routine care. It doesn't pay for it. So families faced with a daily bill of several hundred dollars if the person has to be in a facility. And I think that's the dilemma that paper was trying to point out, that we need a reimbursement system that is able to support people at the end of life, that's not necessarily hospice, but supports their function and their symptom management, and provides for institutional care when it's not really feasible or safe for them to live outside of an institution. Mm-hmm. I think this issue of going back and forth to the hospital and one of the main root causes of that is, when is that just futile? When is that unnecessarily uncomfortable and for the person and their family? And that's a very hard conversation to have, and most people and their families don't have an epiphany about it. But after you go back in and out of the hospital several times, that conversation has to be had. It can be started in the hospital and continued on. But I think that editorial really took a very complex issue and explained it very clearly and offered some policy solutions to it.
You know, I want to finish up with this idea of education that you were talking about in the previous question. And it has become customary in this podcast that the last question tends to be the little more provocative one, respectfully so. But I want to appeal to your role as an educator, both in your capacity at Florida Atlantic and as an author and editor of publications that have guided elder care for years. And on a personal note, I'll say that when I purchased Clinical Geriatrics as a new freshman, I valued that text so much that I put a binder on it. I put a book cover on it. So, and it's still there. Are we missing the mark when it comes to our care of elders in the skilled nursing facility? Maybe this is a question about advanced care planning. Maybe it's more than that. You know, we're all aware that the future of care will not be at the hospital. Eventually, people will start to recognize the hospital as a cost center and that the community is where the higher value care should be. Are we going to be ready at that time to accommodate complex patient needs in the skilled setting? Are we going to be educated enough in the care of this population to provide the quality patient-centered care that you are talking about? What do we need to do, in your opinion, as an actionable step, and as AMDA always says, maybe even tomorrow, to improve coordination of care and or create incentives to reduce our hospital-centric focus?
Well, thanks for the question. It's really a multifaceted question, and there are many areas that could be focused on. But one thing that's embedded in your question is this issue of person-centered care. And I've learned in my over 35 years of geriatrics that person-centered care is paramount. One of the reasons I went into geriatrics is because I like taking care of the whole person and their family situation and all the rest. And we don't have data on what is most effective in many of the clinical situations we face, data from randomized controlled trials. And our patients and families have a wide variety of attitudes, beliefs, and resources available to them, both financial and social, that can influence their decision-making. So I think at the heart of your question about what do we do going forward, I think we need to pay better attention and develop our skills to real person-centered care. Now, having said that, I do think, I'm a believer that education is necessary, but not sufficient to change provider behavior. Mm-hmm. So I'm obviously involved in education. I've been involved in textbooks and journals. But I think the best way, for me, at least teaching, is at the bedside. I don't know as much internal medicine anymore as my internal medicine residents, but I know how to take care of patients. I know how to know when they're sick. I know how to talk to them and their families. And I think that we need to focus on training our workforce in those kind of skills, and not just all the medical and pathophysiology and all the technical aspects of care. So, but I do think that we do have a knowledge base. I spent a lot of time and energy writing medical care in the nursing home many years ago with Dan Osterweil and John Morley. John Morley has edited a book which I contributed to called Nursing Home Care, which is a kind of an international curriculum for clinicians to work in nursing homes. And AMDA has just done an amazing job. I remember going to my first AMDA meeting in Los Angeles. There were about 75 people there. And the certified medical director program, the clinical practice guidelines, all the tools that are available, the podcast that you're doing. And especially, I think, to your question, is there's this now this curriculum for clinicians who work in post-acute care. I think that could be very helpful from an educational standpoint. And I think, you know, from my role on the AMDA Foundation board, I really have been pushing that AMDA needs to use its tools more effectively to train the available workforce and in terms of primary care, not just medical directors. Absolutely done gold standard job of training medical directors and certifying them, but primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, advanced practice nurses who work on a daily basis in post-acute care settings, and especially hospitalists. So we know that hospital systems provider organizations are hiring hospitalists, and they're not, many of them are now, part of their job is to help with the transition in care and actually work in the skilled nursing facility, but they're not prepared for it. And I think that the hospitalists are, that's a potential partial solution to our workforce issue. You have a lot of young, talented physicians who are going into hospital medicine, and if they can get some training and be given the tools to work in the post-acute care setting, we can really improve cares. And I think AMDA is key to that. Another thing I think is key to your question is I think we need to standardize care better and embed that standardized care into tools. And that's essentially what the Interact program does. That's what we're trying to do with the point of care electronic health record. I'm also going to be doing some work with hopefully through Team Health with GeriMed, doing the same thing to embed into the electronic health record ways to improve clinical quality of care, monitor clinical quality of care, and feed it back to providers. Another example of that is a few years ago, we developed expert evidence-based and expert-recommended order sets. So I wish I had these when I was seeing lots of people in post-acute and long-term care, because they really provide guidance. They're not fixed in stone, but they provide guidance. If you think a person has a lower respiratory infection, here's a templated, standardized order set that you can modify based on individual needs. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of a tool. And I'll just say a couple other things. So I agree that in a world of value-based care, the hospital is becoming a cost center, and people recognize that. And I think that that provides a golden opportunity for people who do what we do in geriatrics and post-acute and long-term care. We have to have a trained workforce. We have to have tools to use in practice and education on those tools. We have to have appropriate regulatory and financial incentives to manage people at the lowest level of care that's safe and feasible for them. And I really think AMDA is on the verge of becoming a major force in meeting these challenges and of value-based care and improving care of a very vulnerable population. And that's why I'm so committed to the organization and sit on the board of the foundation. So I would ask everyone listening to this podcast to think about donating their time and some financial support to help strengthen AMDA and its foundation, because there is a lot of good work that we can do.
Well, we have been privileged to speak with and learn from Dr. Joseph Auslander, professor at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine of Florida Atlantic University and renowned researcher, author, educator, and leader in the care of elders. Dr. Auslander, thank you so much for the opportunity and for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
It's been a pleasure, and again, thanks for the opportunity.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by the Foundation for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.